Hong Chen, Jing, Matt Block, Jim Garrison, Donna Shang, Lazik, Matrinich, and Matthew. And the second part of the talk will be still work that we're kind of finishing up here with Yvonne Gonzalez, Roger, and also Lazik and Matthew. And so we really have two main topics today. First is going to be non-Fermi liquid conducting metals. And so here the system that we have in mind is the cuprate superconductors with an eye towards the strange metal in the cuprates. Now, we're not claiming to have really had any direct say in what's going on in that strange metal, but hopefully I'll convince you that we may be onto something as far as how to construct non-Fermi liquids in some way. And in the second half of the talk, I'm going to talk about the Mott transition. So the system we have in mind here is the organic spin liquid compounds, which I'll talk about some. And we ultimately are interested in the nature of the metal spin liquid transition in those materials. And so these are two quite different topics. I mean, they both involve itinerant electrons and some of the synergy. There's some nice synergy between the theory that we use. But one real common theme that I have here is that we are attacking these problems in quasi one dimension. So what we do is very controlled, both numerically and analytically. The physics that we get, the results that we get are really clear analogs of potential 2D physics. Of course, the problem is that we're not in 2D. We're not even close to 2D. And so, so on to non-Fermi liquids. And so our goal here is to construct an example, and really any example, of a non-Fermi liquid metal in two dimensions. And I'm just going to kind of remind people what a Fermi liquid metal is, focusing for simplicity on the momentum distribution function of electrons and of K. So of course, for a free Fermi gas, we just fill up all the states up to the Fermi wave vector, Kf. And in an interacting Landau Fermi liquid, it looks quite similar, except the jump discontinuity doesn't go from 1 to 0 with the Fermi wave vector. It has some jump z, which is less than 1. And this is called the quasi-particle weight. And the volume enclosed by the Fermi surface, the volume of the Fermi sea, is given simply by the density of the electrons. And so basic characteristics of the Fermi liquid is has non-zero z, and the fact that the volume enclosed by the Fermi surface is given basically just by the number of electrons, that goes by the name of Luttinger's volume theorem. And so non-Fermi liquids are kind of tricky because they're just defined by as anything that's not a Fermi liquid. And so you could imagine various ways in which you could have such a phase. You could have the quasi-particle weight z goes to zero. In fact, this is what happens in one dimension, in a Luttinger liquid. Or you could imagine having some state with singular surfaces in momentum space that don't really have anything to do with the density of electrons. And so you could imagine violating Luttinger's volume theorem. And something that experimentalists like to look at, thermodynamic and transport properties, you could get kind of anomalous behavior there. For example, like in the cuprates, we have the resistivity goes as T instead of T squared in the normal metal, and etc. So, so the most famous non-Fermi liquid, perhaps, is that observed in the cuprates above the superconducting dome. So this is the famous phase diagram with hole doping and temperature. And kind of our perspective is that we should try to really understand microscopically what's going on in the strange metal and try to develop some theory for that, for the properties of it. And then at lower temperature, perhaps you could understand the superconductor, some instability of the strange metal. And we're taking the view that the strange metal is an extended zero temperature genuine quantum phase. There is some credence to this idea. Of course, in the cuprates, it doesn't actually exist at zero temperature because it's covered up by the superconductor. But some experiments a few years ago, or they applied really strong magnetic fields, this anomalous transport, you could strip away the superconductor, and this kind of non-Fermi liquid behavior persisted basically all the way to zero temperature over a wide doping range. And so I should note, I mean, what I'm going to present here, we are not claiming to have a theory of this strange metal, really by any means. But what we have done is we've constructed an example of a quantum phase, which is a strange metal. And so how do we do that? So just to be concrete here, I have in mind a system of interacting electrons moving around on the 2D square lattice. We're going to take the approach that goes back to Patrick Lee and others like 20 years ago, where we decompose our electron as a product of a bosonic operator called a chargeon, which carries a charge, and a fermionic operator called a spinon, which carries a spin, coupled to a U1 gauge field. And so that gauge field basically glues together these particles, and the physical electronic Hilbert space on a given site is composed of this boson B and a spinon F. And then what we do, it's kind of a natural thing to do, is put the spinons into a Fermi C state. What the chargeon is doing is really crucial to the resulting phase. So if this boson condenses and takes on some finite expectation value, then C just behaves like F. And we put F into a Fermi C, and so we recover a Fermi liquid. If the chargeon doesn't condense and B takes on zero expectation value, but it still needs to conduct, then all bets are off, and you have a conducting non-Fermi liquid. And so this is one way to perhaps realize a non-Fermi liquid in some concrete way. The problem with this is that bosons always condense, or almost always condense. They really like to. I mean, this is rather general. So what we need is some phase of zero temperature phase of bosons that is conducting and yet uncondensed. And so there aren't really many examples of such a phase. And one of the only ones that may be potentially stable was introduced by Matthew and Lasek already back in 2007. And here we do kind of an interesting construction, which we write the boson operator itself as a product of two more fermions, D1 and D2. And these are also coupled, these two are coupled by a U1 gauge field. And so on a given site, a boson is given by a D1 particle and a D2 particle. And an important detail in this phase is that these kind of daughter fermions, D1 and D2, are taken to have different Fermi surfaces. And to realize the symmetries of the square lattice are taken to have they're rotated by 90 degrees from one another, and one is compressed in the x direction, the other is compressed in the y direction. And this ultimately gives D-wave character in this boson wave function, and that's why we call it the D-wave Bose metal. And furthermore, I mean, there are many exotic properties of this phase that are all discussed in the original paper, and one of the most interesting ones is that, for instance, if you look at the momentum distribution function for the bosons, rather than getting a condensate at zero momentum, you get power loss singularities that reside on entire surfaces in momentum space, somewhat analogous to Fermi surfaces, and we call these things Bose surfaces. So I could talk for a long time about this phase, but what we're going to do is use it as kind of the key to constructing our non-Fermi liquid. So we're just going to put the chargeons into this D-wave Bose metal phase, and this results in a curious-looking all-fermionic decomposition slave particle decomposition of the electron. So now the electron is given by product of D1, D2, and F. And so a spin-up electron, say, now looks like this on a given site. So what's nice is we could, within this construction, we can rather straightforwardly write down variational wave functions, which models this phase. And so a wave function is a very tangible thing. We could do calculations with it. So what we're almost doing here is we're kind of taking a wave function approach to understanding this non-Fermi liquid physics. So in this construction, since each one of these is filling Fermi Cs, we just take a product of three Slater determinants. And I just want to note this is kind of a time reversal invariant analog of how to construct the non-Fermi liquid state for the composite Fermi liquid description of the half-filled Landau level, in which you take Laughlin state and you multiply it by a Fermi C. Here we take our Bose metal and multiply it by a Fermi C. And actually, we're ultimately interested in finding this phase as the ground state of some perhaps reasonable Hamiltonian. So what we've done is we've taken the TJ model and we've augmented it with so we have a TJ model with electron hopping T with no double occupancy and spin exchange J. And we've added this ring exchange term K. And so this is a, it's a, what it does is it takes two, it takes a singlet on opposite corners of a plaquette, and it rotates that singlet 90 degrees. And we can kind of motivate why such terms are promising to realize this kind of physics. And if you just focus on the charge sector, in which we described the boson as a product of D1 and D2 with different hopping patterns. So D1 likes to hop in the X direction, and D2 likes to hop in the Y direction. So if you consider charges on opposite corners here, you kind of splinter them into these constituent slave particles. One likes to hop in the X, the other one likes to hop in the Y. And then they recombine on opposite corners. I mean, that's exactly this kind of ring exchange behavior. And so that's, and there are more rigorous reasons why we're looking at this model, but that's just the basic idea. And so this is an interacting electron model in two dimensions, which is completely intractable due to the sign problem and the fact that there's likely going to be a lot of entanglement in the resulting phases, and so you can't generally use tensor network states in 2D for these kind of problems. However, kind of this phase that I've described, this D-wave metal, which is our non-Fermi liquid, also call it the D-metal to abbreviate, and the Fermi liquid are dramatically distinguishable on quasi-one-dimensional in a quasi-one-dimensional geometry. And so the first step that we've taken is we've placed our TJK model on the two-leg ladder, two legs. The two-leg ladder just constricted to the 2D square lattice constricted to two legs, and we've attacked this problem with really three very complementary methods: density matrix renormalization group, which can almost be, it's basically an exact solution of the model Hamiltonian. In some ways, it can be thought of as an experiment where we have our system and we're solving it exactly, and we could measure various things. And then there's bosonization, which is a low-energy description. We bosonize this kind of gauge theory that I sketched earlier, and this is very controlled. And the variational Monte Carlo is a way to model the phase using wave functions, and then we can make direct comparisons to the DMRG. And so this kind of approach has worked in a number of cases in our group over the last few years, and in particular, it's been shown to work very well for the charge sector part, this bosonic phase of D-wave Bose metal. And so now we're getting into a few details. So what does our phase look like on the two-leg ladder? So we're going to restrict the density to 1/3, and this is the total electron density, so each spin is actually 1/6 filled, so it's somewhat dilute. So we're going to fill Fermi Cs for these various slave particles. So D1 it prefers to hop in the X direction, so it fills two bands on our two-leg ladder. D2 only fills one band, because that second antibonding band splits off, and the spin-on essentially looks like what you would get just for free fermions on this system. So it only fills one band. And so at the mean field level, when all these kind of slave particles are roaming around and not talking to each other, either through interactions or gauge fields or anything, then you're starting out off with some system that has five partially filled bands. You have one, two, three, and then you have two spins, so you have four or five. And then upon doing the projection, in which you glue D1 and D2 and F all to a so that what that does is that kills two of these gapless modes, and you get some exotic Luttinger liquid with three gapless modes along this two-leg ladder. And so here's just to summarize before I go into some more details. Here's what our phase diagram looks like in the variables K and J. So for small k, we have what I'm calling a Fermi liquid. It's not actually a Fermi liquid. It's just a conventional one-band Luttinger liquid, which would be the analog of the Fermi liquid on the two-leg ladder. And then this large swath of the phase diagram, we're pretty confident that we've realized precisely the phase that I just described by that wave function in the DMRG. And it phase separates out here, and this is some fully polarized trivial state. which is important. But so let's go back to what the momentum distribution function of the electrons looks like, say, for small k and large k. So at small k, like a half, it looks almost exactly like you would get in just a free Fermi gas. We're just filling up, we're filling up electronic states up to some Fermi wave vector determined entirely by the density, by the number of electrons. And then in our D-wave metal, which we believe is our D-wave metal, this is what it looks like. And at first glance, if you were to just do this kind of DMRG calculation and measure this momentum distribution function, you would be baffled. Because nothing, I mean, we don't know of any, we would have no idea what's going on. This is rather bizarre. However, this is longitudinal momentum QX, by the way, and this is the measurement in the Y direction. The different curves are the different bonding and anti-bonding bands, QY equals 0 and pi, and the solid curves are the DMRG. But the dashed curves is the variational Monte Carlo calculation, which is, so we've done an energetic study of this model using various classes of wave functions, and the lowest energy state has a momentum distribution function that looks like this. And so you could see that the agreement is rather astonishing. And so we could understand that all this behavior coming from this non-Fermi liquid picture. And furthermore, you get these singularities, momentum space, where the momentum distribution drops in the bonding band and it actually increases in the anti-bonding band. And these features move around, for instance, with K. And so how exactly do we understand this behavior coming from this picture? Well, there's kind of a quote-unquote simple explanation. If you just look at the mean field limit in which, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a kind of a mean field description in which I treat the bosons as the D1 and D2 is strongly coupled, but they're not coupled to the Fs. And so then the momentum distribution function of the electrons just becomes a convolution. And so this is actually what the momentum distribution function looks like for the bosons in the Bose metal phase. So this was a result from Donna back in 2008. And so rather than getting some quasi-condensate peak at zero momentum, you get these sharp singularities at incommensurate wave vectors. And we can understand where these are coming from the D1 and D2 particles. And so if you kind of approximate that with delta functions, just to sketch, and then we're putting these spin-ons into some ordinary simple Fermi C. So then you take this convolution, and you convolve these delta functions with this step function, you get a picture that looks like this. And that's qualitatively what we see in this electron momentum distribution function for this phase. And we could understand, like, at a very fine, kind of fine quantitative level, why some of those features are sharper than others and such. And an example is that the when you bosonize this gauge theory on a two-leg ladder, so there's in these gauge theory there's something called an Empyrean rule, and so if you have composites that carry parallel gauge charge, they will be attracted to one another, and so D1 and D2, they need to be glued together on a given site, and so they carry opposite gauge charge with respect to that gauge field. And so what we want to do is we want to create a right-moving D1 and a left-moving D2. And then, so we create a right-moving D1, a left-moving D2, and then we create a right-moving spin-on. And this projects in a finite way exactly onto the fields that get pinned when you integrate out the gauge field. And so these are the bosonized fields. This is kind of complicated, but all that you need to know is that these things theta, when we integrate out the gauge field, they just basically get pinned to some value, and so the slowly varying piece of the electron at this wave vector ke, that fluctuating content is decreased, and that's why we get these sharp steps at this wave vector, which we could understand from these constituent slave particles just by simply adding up these various wave vectors. And so that's kind of an understanding of that landscape of the electron. There's also, I could play the same game for density and spin correlations. And we also get great agreement between the DMRG and the VMC. We get various features, which we can be understood as various 2kF wave vectors coming from these slave particles and everything. But again, the main point to take away is that we basically understand all this. You can just see by just comparing these the DMRG and the VMC, which is modeling this phase. And so as a kind of final, smoking gun to nail down that we have this phase, we can measure the central charge via the entanglement entropy in the DMRG. And so in what I'm calling the Fermi liquid, this just one band Luttinger liquid with spin and charge, two spins or spin and charge, then you should get two gapless modes, C equals two. We get that. So in our D-wave metal, so at the mean field level, we have five gapless modes that the two gauge fields gaps out two of those, and we expect C equals three, which is a completely non-trivial result. And that's basically what we get in the DMRG. Some of this behavior here is finite size effects and various other things, we believe. And so to kind of conclude this part of the talk, so what we've done is we've constructed some explicit example of a non-Fermi liquid, the D-wave metal, and we have, we believe, very strong evidence that this phase is stable, at least on the two-leg ladder, using this kind of three-pronged combination of DMRG, VMC, variational Monte Carlo, and bosonization. And really, maybe the most important thing to take away is that this phase is something that's very qualitatively new. In particular, we believe that you can't realize this phase just starting from some, say, free electrons and turning on weak interactions. You can't use that starting point. You really need to use this kind of exotic slave particle approach. So this is kind of some intrinsically like non-perturbative or strong coupling phase. And so ongoing work that we're still working on here, going to higher densities on the two-leg ladder, maybe going to three, four-leg ladder eventually, and also just doing a variational study using variational Monte Carlo in full two dimensions. And kind of future work kind of way down the line. We could more seriously consider the actual 2D theory, which is something that's really complicated and something that I would probably never try to touch. And try to actually match the cuprate phenomenology in some limit. We have some ideas on how that might work, but it's this ring exchange term was at least microscopically very important to stabilize that phase. And it would be interesting. There's a kind of process where you could try to using ab initio methods where you might try to estimate its strength, say in the cuprate or some other material, to maybe actually see this physics in some real model or in some real material. Whereas we do have it in some model, perhaps. So at the mean field level, You have five gapless modes. You have two in this D1 sector, you have one in the D2 sector, and you have two in the spin sector, F up and F down. So then you could bosonize those five modes. You could decompose left and right movers and then bosonize them. And then what happens is then you have to add these two gauge fields. There's two gauge fields. Exactly, And then once you integrate out those two gauge fields, you generate mass terms for two combinations of these bosonized fields. And the electron projects right onto those two combinations, like at these enhanced wave vectors, and also in the spin and density and everything. And so
do you always have two common surface for D1?
Yeah. So this is, yeah.
Okay.
So that's why Yeah, I mean, when we realize the phase, then we always have, it's always filling two bands in D1, and yeah, and really this the location of this feature, which I'm calling KE, is really just the difference in those two wave vectors in D1. So if you took D1 to have say the same, so the limit in which this phase might connect to say the Fermi liquid would be as if you were to take D1 and drain out all particles from the antibonding band, and then this just becomes then at least from the wave function perspective, this just becomes a square of a determinant. So that's almost kind of like some, it would be some kind of bad approximation of a superfluid maybe, and then you just basically recover the, you'd probably get some pairing instability actually in the theory too, and then you would get sequels too. But generally, in like the mother phase, we have 2, 1, 2.
If your gauge field is not capped, gauge field
in 1D, yeah, it's not yet.
Then, in some sense, this is not qualitatively similar to 2D.
It might not, yeah. I mean, it's, yeah. How that connects is kind of, yeah.
Do you expect as the number of light increases, the gap kind of increases?
Yeah, you would expect, if it were to be stable, yeah. If, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Whether or not it's actually stable in a model, but in the theory, that would yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good. So I don't get why there is two gauge field, because I think there is only one constraint, like your three particles has to glue together to become one. So that's one constraint.
No, I mean, it's, but you have to glue all three of them. I mean, you have to. For every degree of freedom, you have to. You can think of gluing together two of them, and then gluing together. That becomes some. I mean, just because there's three, and you need to connect them into. I mean, I think that's. Because when you write out, the density of the. So what you really have is you have the density of D1 equals the density of D2 equals the density of spin-ons. So that concludes this first half on the non-Fermi liquids. The second half is maybe slightly less technical, hopefully. So now I'm going to talk about the Mott transition. And so now we have in mind a system. Also, we have interacting itinerant electrons, but they're at half filling. So we have one particle per site on some 2D lattice with some Coulomb repulsion. And so in this system, I mean, kind of the basic description of it would be some Hubbard model. So you have electron hopping T and, say, on-site or maybe more generalized interactions U. And in general, it's small u, you'll have some metal because we're at half filling, and band theory will predict that we have a metal. But at some finite value of the interaction strength, the system becomes insulating, and it becomes a Mott insulator. And so this is due to Neville Mott, pictured here. And so the big questions here is, what is the nature of the Mott transition at zero temperature? And also, can it ever be a continuous phase transition or second order? And I mean, these things kind of depend on the specific system you have in mind. And really, the nature of this insulating phase, this Mott insulator in your system, the nature of that is going to be important. So almost always, Mott insulators have magnetic order. And so you go to large enough U, then you get some effective spin model. So in the Hubbard model, you get the Heisenberg model. And say on a bipartite lattice, we know that it'll have an AL order. And so what does this mean for the transition between the metal and the Mott insulator? For a direct transition, so if you don't have any, say, magnetic order in the metal, then you must have two things happening at once. You have to have the electrons localizing due to that strong Coulomb repulsion, and you have to have the magnetic order developing. They have to happen simultaneously. And so clearly a continuous transition wouldn't be generic, and in fact, first order then becomes likely. And so here are a couple well-studied recent examples of first-order Mott transitions. in experiments. And so we're interested in trying to answer if such a Mott transition can be continuous. And really what kind of revitalized this interest is these organic spin liquid compounds. They're rather complicated. This one goes by the name Kappa ET, kind of an abbreviation. This one DMIT. So these are quasi two-dimensional. So here's a picture of what these materials look like. So they're layered organic compounds, which actually form a 2D triangular lattice. And experimentally, it's very clear that at ambient pressure, they're insulators. They're charged insulators with no magnetic order down to extremely low temperatures, like four orders of magnitude less than the Heisenberg exchange J. And moreover, we can drive a Mott transition from this spin liquid, which is this insulator with no magnetic order, into a metal by simply applying hydrostatic pressure. Of moderate amounts. And so here's like a phase diagram in temperature and pressure of one of this Kappa ET organic spin liquid. So it's a spin liquid out here, and when we apply pressure, we go into a metal at very low temperatures. It becomes superconducting. And it's rather remarkable that it's believed, and maybe it's not 100% agreed upon, that we can describe this physics with just a half-filled Hubbard model on the triangular lattice, perhaps with some anisotropy in the rotational anisotropy. But so what exactly is the nature of these spin liquids? What are their physical properties? So I think maybe the most important thing to note is that these Mott insulators are weak. And so U over T is large enough to make the system a Mott insulator, but it's not extremely large. And so it's believed that the charge gap is small in these materials. And so what this means is that we have a rather large charge correlation length, even though it's an insulator. And so we have substantial local charge fluctuation. And one way to kind of model this behavior is to go beyond the Heisenberg model. And perhaps what we end up doing is another ring term, a different ring term from before, which I'll talk about soon. And so experimentally, and the thermodynamic and various experiments on these materials indicates that there's likely many low-lying spin excitations. The exact nature of those excitations at the lowest temperatures in the two materials is still rather controversial. But a real beautiful kind of theoretical starting point to describe these materials involves just taking a Fermi surface of spinons, of up and down spinons, the same kind of objects we were talking about before, and coupling them to a UN gauge field. So this is really, this part of the theoretically, what we're doing here is very similar to what was going on in the spin sector in the first part of the talk. And in California, we call this phase the Spinbose metal. And so this was developed in 2005 by Lasik and Sung-sik, who's in the audience, and Patrick Lee. And the simple way to describe this phase is you just take spin up and spin down fermions on some lattice at half filling, so exactly one per site on average, and you project out all doubly occupied sites. You just get rid of all parts of the wave function that don't have that have double occupancy. And so why we call it the Spinbose metal? You can't really see. It inherits, so the spin sector of this phase is qualitatively very similar to what you have in a metal. And we know in a metal that we have like 2kF wave vectors in the spin. And this set of wave vectors forms a surface in momentum space. And and the spin operator is a bosonic operator. And so that's why we call it the Spinbose metal, essentially. And so, in this case, if the insulating part of the problem is in the spin liquid described by the Spinbose metal, and then a continuous Mott transition is really a kind of a distinct possibility. And it really, I mean, it goes back to the fact that the spin sector of the spin-Bose metal is very similar to the spin sector of the metal itself. And so you could think maybe across the Mott transition, the spin isn't really doing anything. It just kind of comes along for the ride. And so this was developed in detail by Senthil and the Toronto group in 2D and later in 3D. And here we actually, they use the same construction as we were using before. And when you splinter the electron now as a, also as a boson, as a charge-on and a spin-on. And what Senthil argued was that near the Mott transition, kind of the spin-on and charge-on essentially decouple. And it's really the charge-on is what's carrying the charge. And so really the Mott transition, and this charge-on is a boson, and so the universality class of the Mott transition for electrons is exactly what you get for bosons. So here's some pictures that David Moss and Senthil used to kind of show what's going on. So and the two phases, the Mott insulator and the metal, can be distinguished by whether or not the charge-on takes on some finite expectation value. So here the charge-on condenses, and we get a metal. So in the spin-Bose metal, the charge-on is forming a unit-filled Mott insulator. And so it doesn't condense, and you can see that the charge part is getting attached to the ions, while the spin is still free in some sense. And so that's just a caricature of the electronic version of our spin-Bose metal. And so what we're interested in doing is seeing if we could kind of realize the kind of physics perhaps proposed by Senthil kind of in quasi-one dimension, like we did before. And so what we're going to do is we're going to place the triangular lattice, again, on the two-leg ladder as a first step. And so an important development occurred back in 2009 when Donna, Lazik, and Matthew, they studied a pure spin model on the two-leg ladder and found extremely extensive evidence for the stability of a two-leg descendant of the spin-Bose metal phase in this pure spin model. And the spin model that they used was originally proposed by Lazik in 2D, but you just take the Heisenberg model with S dot S. So in this one-dimensional geometry, we're just going to label sites like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and take it as essentially 1D with kind of next nearest neighbor exchange. And we have an all-important term here. This is another ring exchange term. I'm going to call it K again. And what it does, it just cycles the spin configurations around every plaquette in the lattice. Just like the Heisenberg just exchanges two spins, the ring exchange exchanges four. And so there's really kind of two ways that you can think about this two-leg spin-Bose metal. So one, you could consider coupling spin-ons, which are kind of fictitious objects, to a UN gauge field. And so a picture, like a wave function picture for what's going on here. So this is what the dispersion looks like in this one. So we're taking this kind of one-dimensional picture. And if you work out the dispersion at half filling beyond for a certain range of parameters, it fills two disconnected Fermi Cs in 1D. And then if you take those up and down spin-ons, you fill those that Fermi C, you do a projection to only the sector with one particle per site, and that's what Donna and company studied back in 2009, in this pure spin model. But what we're going to do is you could also realize this phase with real electrons, just real deal electrons moving around on the two-leg ladder at half filling. There's a scenario in which there's an allowed 8 fermion Umklapp term, which it involves 8 fermions. So at weak coupling, it has scaling dimension 4, and it's strongly irrelevant. But it can be driven relevant at moderate to strong interactions. And so what we do is we start off with a two band Lettinger liquid with spin. So this is a four-mode Lettinger liquid. And there's some labeling scheme that Matthew and Leon developed a while back. So C alpha S beta means we have a Lettinger liquid with alpha gapless charge modes and beta gapless spin modes. And so the spin Bose metal in this Lettinger liquid picture involves taking this metal, this thing, which is basically it's continuously connected to like the free Fermi gas on the two-leg ladder, and gapping out only the overall conducting charge mode. And so here's like what the Lagrangian would look like in this case. When you bosonize this umklopp, you get this cosine of this overall charge mode theta rho plus. And so the lower energy theory is really just a Sine-Gordon theory in this 1D system. And so that's all fine and well, but what Hamiltonians, what models should we consider? So it turns out the Hubbard model itself doesn't quite work. And that's ultimately because there's a large tendency in the metal for the spin to be gapped. In the spin-Bose metal, the spin is completely gapless. You have as many gapless modes in the spin as you possibly could. You have three, in fact. And so when you go across the Mott transition, the insulator is also likely spin gapped. We basically confirmed this, and as others have over the years. So Lasik and Lay, they had an idea to kind of fight that spin gap. So really the problem is that the spin gapless metal in this two-leg ladder is kind of unstable. And this is really kind of an analog of a superconductor. When you gap out all the spin, you only have the charge. And so they said, you know, we could fight that spin gap by adding extended repulsion. And so we've also been playing around with this, and it's looking promising, but the data is still too new to present. And so what I'm going to present today is we're going to try to realize this physics by kind of playing with a toy model in which we take for the interactions exactly the spin terms that Donna and company in 2009 used to stabilize the spin version of this spin Bose metal. And so what's nice is we're guaranteed, at least for infinite k, for only k, if you turn off the electron hopping, we just go back to what Donna had, and we know that we're in our spin Bose metal. And so we expect some. So here's what the model looks like on the two-leg ladder. We have electrons at half filling. We have hopping t, nearest neighbor hopping t, next nearest neighbor hopping t prime, and we have three terms. We have this Heisenberg exchange J1 and J2, and this ring exchange term k. Here's kind of a suggested phase diagram. So at 0 k, we just have free fermions on the two-leg ladder. At infinite k, we recover what Donna did. And so we expect maybe there's some Mott transition in the middle. And so this is what we're going to what we've investigated numerically. And we're going to focus on really the same three quantities I talked about before: the momentum distribution function for the electron, the spin-spin structure factor, and the density-density structure factor. And then there's some stiffnesses in this theory, which I'm calling Lettinger parameters, and they're really just the slopes of these quantities at zero momentum for the spin and the charge. And the only thing that's really important here is that we could actually directly measure the scaling dimension of that umklopp by looking by measuring this quantity g rho plus, which comes out of the density-density structure factor. And so if delta of the scaling dimension of that umklopp drops below 2, then we know it has to be active, and we're in an insulating phase. And so here's, if you kind of, if so we're just going to focus on the spin and density structure factor to start with. So comparing free fermions, so this is just free fermions on the two-leg, on this two-band system, and the same spin Bose metal, for the same parameter, for the same dispersion, for the spin-ons and the electrons. And so for free fermions, we just get various 2kF wave vectors in these structure factors, which have slope discontinuities. And this is all very simple. You can just all work this out by hand. And also the spin and density structure factors have linear behavior near zero momentum. So this is a metal. So the spin Bose metal, so the spin, like I said, the spin is almost qualitatively similar to what's happening in the metal, except we have rather drastic quantitative differences in the structure of these 2K of wave vectors, which we understand well. And this is a pure insulator with no hopping, and so the density-density structure factor is identically zero. And so we'd like to realize maybe perhaps a Mott transition between these two states. And so I was going to show. Show the data here. I don't know why it has. There shouldn't be two, but it's the same thing, I guess. Just pay attention to one of the left or right. So this is what happens at very large hopping. I can't do full screen. So this is fine. So this is free fermions. And so we have these slope discontinuities and the density and spin structure factor. We have, and this is a momentum distribution function. So you just have these filled Fermi Cs in this two-band system. And this is really measuring this charge Lettinger parameter, which measures the scaling dimension of the umklopf. And the important thing to note is if this thing drops below 1/2, the system becomes insulating. And the theory predicts a universal drop in this quantity, in the thermodynamic limit, from 1/2 to zero at the Mott transition. And so what I'm doing is now turning on the interactions. So things aren't looking too different. And eventually, when our G rho plus quantity gets near 1/2, a few things happen. So we essentially tune exactly into this electronic version of the spin-Bose metal. And so the density, so the electron Green's function becomes exponentially decaying, so it's smooth. The spin structure factor becomes enhanced, and I'll explain that shortly. And also, well into the insulator, even though it's a charge insulator, we still have power law decay in the density-density structure factor at 2K of wave vectors. And for an insulator, that's kind of a rather exotic phenomena. And we could understand all of this by looking at the bosonization. And so first off, so this is a finite size analysis of that Lettinger parameter G rho plus, and the theory predicts a universal drop at the Mott transition from 1/2 to zero. And so that doesn't happen on a finite size system, but we could essentially confirm this Kosterless thallus, or this 1+1dxy universality that's expected in this from gapping out this overall charge mode in this Sine-Gordon theory by doing a finite size fit to this data. So this is just kind of a classic way to confirm an xy transition. And we've basically done that. So in Senthil's kind of proposal, in 2D, he said that the Mott transition is 3dxy. And so this is kind of very much an analog of that in 1+1D, where we can basically confirm this KT scaling. And so to kind of, we've done that, and we've kind of estimated exactly where the transition is. So this black curve is the Mott transition, and now I'm plotting the spin structure factor, kind of tuning between the metal and the insulator. And we see that as we go from the metal to the insulator, kind of what happens is these peaks, they remain, and they just become sharper. And we could understand this by kind of going to the bosonization and writing down these operators. And the slowly varying piece is indeed proportional to this mode that's getting gapped. So this thing becomes massive. And so this field fluctuates less. And so in momentum space, that means that the feature becomes stronger. And so this is also a kind of another 1+1D realization of Ampérian enhancement. And here's what the density structure factor is doing. So here's what it looks like in the metal as we go into the insulator. Those kind of 2KF wave vectors remain. And in fact, they should still be there. In fact, they could in principle be enhanced by the exact same mechanism what happens with the spin when you write down this operator in terms of all the Bose-Nice fields. We don't, it's hard to tell if they're really getting enhanced or not, but they're certainly still there in the insulator. So we have like charge, like 2kF charge for Dell oscillations even in this insulator, and this was predicted in also in 2D by Senthil a couple years ago in this electronic spin Bose metal. And finally, the momentum distribution function, as you turn from the metal, as you tune from the metal into the insulator, kind of those Fermi points, they disappear simultaneously. And again, this is expected at a Mott transition, particularly at this kind of Mott transition. Now, it turns out there is a potential problem here, because something that we only noticed recently is that the spin might be, so this is, I won't go into details, but the spin might not be doing exactly what we want it to be doing. There might be a small spin gap underlying the metal and just on the insulating side. And this, we can probe this in a particular way, which I won't go into. And so really, rather than having gapless spin-ons or gapless electrons kind of becoming gapless spin-ons across the transition, we might have weakly gapped electrons becoming weakly gapped spin-ons, and then there might be, I mean, this is kind of, it's just not quite what we want it to be, but it's close. And so at least in this hopping plus ring model, which I presented, we do think we have clear 1 plus 1D, like XY universality of the Mott transition. The there might be a small spin gap underlying it, and so the kind of the 2D analog would be not the Fermi liquid to the spin Bose metal, but maybe a superconductor to some weak instability of the spin Bose metal, which actually is possibly what's going on in one of these organic materials. Data that we're still working on, and it's looking more promising to actually realize the spin physics that we want, is this extended Hubbard model. We just take the Hubbard model and we add second, third, fourth neighbor interactions parameterized in some way, and it looks like we perhaps are avoiding the spin gap in the metal. And this kind of model is probably rather, these kind of extended Hubbard interactions are thought to be important in these organics coming from ab initio calculations. So we can maybe have some first step towards describing these materials, at least in these quasi 1D systems. So I think that's all. Thank you.
Questions?
Yep.
Okay, I came in a little late, so I missed another part of your presentation, but I wonder if you could put back the transparency into the lab. When you initially define the ladder, is the ring exchange that's defined on the ladder referring to a triangular ring?
For which
which
ring term?
You had a picture with the ladder, and it showed the rings, but I missed whether the rings themselves are triangular.
Yeah, so on the square lattice, or?
Yes, whether it's a square ring or a triangular ring.
In this case, it's square. It operates on all square plaquettes.
And the uppercase K, this is a very naive question, refers to the strength of the ring exchange.
Yep.
And the ring is a... has a single fermionic mode on it, for example, can you look at the ring, a single ring, the ring that you refer to, ring to which K applies?
Yeah. So so this is a term in the Hamiltonian, and this is a picture of what that term is doing, and so it.
Is that a pure state on the square ring, or is it a renormalized state?
Well, so this is just a term in the Hamiltonian, so it's not really a state, but it operates on what it does. I mean, this is just depicting what it does, what these operators are doing. So this is, I'm not even defining what the S is, what it does, it takes a singlet and it rotates a singlet. So if you're only looking at a singlet on one plaquette, yeah, I mean, that's of course a pure state.
Okay,
but if you have a...
If I could ask one, just follow up on that. Is it that K operates within the ring or between two rings?
Within a plaquette. It operates on each plaquette. Yeah, so this is like a state here.
Yes.
And there's a minus sign just depicting like a singlet. Maybe that's not the clear.
I see. So I'm just thinking whether this entire ladder is a is just a theoretical picture, or whether it could be realized in some spintronic material.
It's possible, but we'd have no, you'd have to, if you could, like, it's not known. I mean, it's conceivable, but maybe not. I'd have no idea where to look.
Well, it's a very interesting talk.
Nobody's ever I don't think anybody's ever considered this term before. I mean, this is a.
So the new thing that you're doing is coming up with an understanding of an extension to the Hubbard model, which involves the K.
Yeah, I mean that's that in the from the perspective of the model.
So nobody else has worked on KPJ models.
Nobody had any reason to before. I mean, we kind of had. I mean, Matthew and Lasik, they had this phase in mind, and we kind of. It's kind of backward. Usually you might, you know, most people would start with that maybe material Hamiltonian theory. It's almost, we start with the theory, back out a Hamiltonian, then maybe that Hamiltonian's relevant to material, but it's hard to say.
Very interesting talk anyway. I just have very naive questions, so please.
So you really not coming back to the previous discussion, right? This is really a model engineering in a sense, right? You don't
really have
in mind that these this ring is derived from a strong coupling expansion from a an electron problem, right? Because then once you get into the metallic phase, the strong coupling expansion wouldn't make sense. Right?
Yeah. Well,
so you might be able to describe the spin liquid phase within the MUT regime within the strong expansion, but
oh, you're talking about the other ring term? So these are different, there's two ring terms. In the second one, that's really kind of a toy model. I mean, having that K explicit in the metal, like deep into the metal, that's really not maybe all that realistic. Whereas deep in the insulator it is, but yeah.
And it doesn't have the symmetry of the ring term that you would get in a large U expansion in the Hubbard.
It doesn't have the symmetry?
It's not. It doesn't have all the terms of like the ring change.
Yeah, it does. Which one? That's what exactly what it is. What?
It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
It's exactly that same term.
That's u.
T to the fourth over u cubed. It's got different s dot s. Yeah, it's.
But then in the first case, when you have this hopping and you're not at half filling, shouldn't there be some kind of prefactor, which is one minus the occupation factor? Like, isn't there?
It's kind of a correlated hopping term, but it's different. I mean, it's kind of in the spirit of that, but
derive a TJ.
That would be there. Yeah, absolutely. But we don't care. We're interested in the phase, whether or not. I mean, that term, it could do something else. It could destabilize this phase.
So the idea is, if the phase exists, it's stable over some range, and how you would get it is somewhere else.
That's
problem.
Yep. Yeah, I mean.
Okay. Other questions? Not. Let's thank Greg again.